Welcome to the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. My name is Lauren Wells, here with my co-host, Chris Seveny. We're committed to providing you with the knowledge required to build wealth through real estate investing. Tired of consuming content about real estate? Stuck in analysis paralysis? Ready to do your first deal? As a member of our community, you will learn how to go from consuming content to taking that first step into the world of real estate investing. Our show is not about getting rich quick, but about providing you with the knowledge you need to take action. Join us as we speak with experienced investors who share action tips on how to escape the corporate world, start a thriving side hustle in the world of real estate, and go beyond your W-2 or 401k. Welcome, everybody, to the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast, where each week we bring you education and information to help you take your next step in building wealth through real estate. My name is Lauren Wells. I am your host. Short today, Chris, who is actually not feeling well, which seems like a theme of the past season. But I am joined by Nathan Smith, who is a real estate investor and industry leader in creative financing and asset management. He reached financial independence at the age of 30 and currently owns over 200 doors, you know, totaling approximately $24 million in assets. He has founded multiple real estate businesses, including Clearwater Capital Group, which is a real estate investment company that delivers dependable cash flow and appreciation, while also owning a property management company that managed over 1,000 units at the time of his exit. So one of his passions is teaching others about the power of investing in real estate. And I think that's kind of why we're here, because that's what we want to do is help educate and get other people started on their journey. So welcome, Nathan.
Hey, thanks for having me. Yeah, I love just having high-level conversations about this stuff. It's my passion, your passion, and obviously, hopefully, the audience's passion. So hopefully, we can provide some value today.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've done quite a bit. And I mean, reaching that financial independence at the age of 30, I feel like that's whenever people are Googling what they want to do, it's how do I get out of the rat race? How do I quit my job? How do I invest in real estate so I can do that? So you did it. So let's dive into that. How did you get started? At what age did you get started?
Yeah, for sure. I guess early on, I always just bent towards entrepreneurship, and that morphed into a lot of small businesses growing up. But really, like, in my opinion, wealth is built through like a repeatable system. So when that really started was in college when I bought my first rental property. It was actually, I was going to get my doctorate at the University of Wisconsin, and my dad helped me buy what's known today as a house hack, where you just buy a house, you live in a room and you rent out the other rooms to friends, or it doesn't even have to be friends, just to anybody else. But they were just friends at the time. Back then it wasn't called house hacking. It was just seemed to make sense. And that's kind of where it started. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that's where it started for me.
Awesome. And then, okay, so you graduated. Well, did you finish? Did you get your doctorate?
I did. The amount of beer in Madison, Wisconsin is plentiful, but I still managed to make it to class a little bit, and I did get my doctorate. So I practiced as a pharmacist full-time for about, what was it, like 5 years? And then ever since then, I've been kind of dabbling in and out. Like, I still maintain my licenses just to have that fallback, just to be safe. Yeah. But yeah, I focus more on real estate now and being a dad and a husband. But yeah, I did manage to make it through.
Okay, you made it through. So you graduated, you had that house. What was like, I guess, at that point, you obviously saw that worked. Like, I can make money off of this. How did you grow your portfolio? I imagine at your doctorate, you're like, what, 24, 25-ish? So in five years, you're, you know, in a good place. What steps did you take and kind of what did you invest in?
Yeah, absolutely. So that first investment is actually, I made a fair amount of mistakes on it. It just kind of broke even. It was in a great market. Madison, Wisconsin's a great market, appreciation-wise and all that, but it's a little tougher on cash flow from like a Midwest market. It's kind of more of a white-collar Midwest market, if you would say. Yeah. Nothing compared to California, but it was just kind of a break even, honestly. So I kind of recalibrated. I was learning a lot during those first couple of years. And I went back and I actually invested in where I went to undergrad, which is a little town called Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Okay. And I started buying there just because cash flow is so much higher. The price point was so cheap. And I just started just picking them off as quick as possible. And one of the big keys that I did, I think, that allowed me to scale so quickly is I kept living exactly like I was in grad school for the first couple of years after I graduated. So my income went way up, obviously, when I started working as a pharmacist, but my lifestyle really didn't. I didn't buy any car. I didn't buy a house. I just lived like a college kid, and I just kept buying these rental properties every quarter. And then I kind of figured out some more things, creative financing wise, and I really kind of ramped it up from there.
Love it. And if anyone is listening to this podcast and did not listen to last week's or this week's release, last week's release, the episode before this, we talk all about this. That is a big part of it. And something I'm hearing continually is like keeping your lifestyle the same, not necessarily making more money to spend more money, but like if you want to get ahead, it's okay, set that budget and use the extra funds to really get yourself ahead. So couple of questions. What single family homes, I'm assuming, is what you invested in?
Yeah, sort of. Single, small multis. That's kind of my bread and butter. I don't really buy single families. So like my first one was a single family, then it was a duplex, then a single family, then it kind of right in there, yeah. 1 to 4 units.
1 to 4 units. Yeah, that seems to be like its own asset class. So, okay, why did you decide on that? And then why that town? Like, did you just go for it? Did you have any hesitancy or fear around like, shit, what if this doesn't work?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So deciding on the town, at that point in my life, there was very few markets I had intimate knowledge in. I think that's the key, is you need to have some sort of leg in a market to give you that advantage over other people, honestly. Like if I just want to go invest in Orlando, Florida, sure, I can interview the best property managers. I can figure out who's a really good real estate agent. I can build a team down there, but I don't have a competitive advantage. And I think that's really key if you're investing somewhere. Your competencies, everybody has them. That's probably where you should invest, right? So I knew that market because I just lived there for 4 years as an undergrad student. So I was like 2 years removed. I knew where kids like to live. And that's what I started into. I'll say this is I did a lot of student housing right away. So it was like, I knew exactly where you wanted to live if you were going to school there. What was the other part of the question? Oh, hesitancy?
Yeah, like, just like, I mean, you got your doctorate, you're working. Like any thoughts where you're like, do I really want to do this? Should I just keep doing the pharmacy thing? And Yeah,
not really. I mean, everybody has hesitancies, but I think what's your alternative? And I don't think a lot of people think through this very well, right? Is my alternative was I worked for Walgreens, and I still do, at a Walgreens pharmacy, which is not a glamorous job, for 40 years of my life, 40 hours a week, and begging my boss to get vacations. When you really stack that up, and I don't think enough people do this, they just like have their job and they're like, this is how it is. No, it doesn't have to be that way. And I think if people just sat down and like laid out the pros and the cons, it was kind of a no-brainer. It's like, this might not be it, these investment rental properties that I'm doing, but I need to find something that makes it so I don't have to do this column over here. I want to move over to this column where I control my time. So if the rental properties didn't work, but they did, I would have done something else. And I think just having that attitude is really important.
I think you hit it right there, just saying that there is a lot of a mindset that goes into it and really laying out, like, you have to feel the pain and or see the pain of like 40 years of sitting at a desk. And you know what? And I don't knock people if they're okay with that. And that's like, you don't mind that. That's cool. But for people who are looking to create something else for themselves and they don't want that, I mean, you really have to get to a point where you feel that pain of doing that every day. And like you said, asking for vacations. And you're a dad now. You've been hit by this winter season. I mean, how many times has your kid been sick?
Yeah, like this is like the third sickness we're on right now. Yeah.
Yeah. So imagine not having that flexibility to be like, I need to be home with my kids. So just kind of like you said, mapping out, okay, this may not be it, but this is going to give me some lesson learned to go on and take the next step to find whatever it is that does work.
Yeah.
Luckily, it worked out for you. For
yeah,
sure.
Exactly. Yeah. One thing I'll say too, and this is maybe a little deeper, you hit it on, you need to be in that to realize the pain of that. And this, what I did, it fed two things. It gave me more cash. And then it also rubbed my face in the job enough where I really did not like going to work. So what I would do is I would work full time and I did what's called a 770 shift. I'd work 70 hours in 7 days and I'd have a week off. It was an overnight shift. But then I would just pick up hours on my off. And that's me rubbing my face in my job, hating it, doing 60 hours a week. But it also gave me more cash to invest, right? So it's fed two things. My hate for my job, wanting to get out of it, and two, more cash to invest in more rental properties. That definitely might not be for everybody because I burnt myself out after 3 or 4 years. But to your point, you need to develop that disdain for your situation. Like, that is very, very important. Change doesn't happen until we reach a certain point of uncomfortable or dislike for our current situation. I believe that.
Yeah. And I think that can apply to not just like your job, but like lifestyle, all the things. Like, you have to reach a point where you're like, I can't, no more. Like, I need to make changes or whatever. Perfect New Year's like episode right here. Okay. So I guess from an outside view, it looks like everything went like super well. Talk to us about some of the things that went wrong in your first few years.
Yeah, absolutely. So when any investor starting off, especially in real estate, usually your limiting ability is cash and capital, right? Whether it's raising capital or it's just you're funding your own deals. I was funding most of my own deals at the time. There's been a couple points in my career where I've expanded too quickly and not had enough cash in reserves. And that's caused some stress in 6-8 months of me having to really kind of dial it back and figure things out. So having those strong cash reserves and realizing that things are generally going to cost a little bit more than you think they are. Like, we all have a bias, like when we're running an analysis on properties, that we think the rents are going to be a little higher than they probably are. And the renovations are going to cost a little less than they probably will. Just knowing those biases now has really helped me out. Like I said, that first property was in no way a slam dunk whatsoever. I think we bought it for like $275,000. I renovated the basement for like $15,000 and we held it for 5 years. And I think I sold it for like $325,000. So nothing great. And it like broke even cash flow wise. It was just an education. So like that was like a 5-year crash course education. It wasn't like I was rolling in money or anything like that. It was just an education. So like, honestly, my first 3 or 4 years of investing, there wasn't a lot of success reinforcing it. I just knew of the foundational principles of passive income and wealth and debt pay down. I knew that I was on the right path, I guess you could say. Other things, for some reason, things come in threes. So like, good things happen and they happen in threes, and then bad things happen in threes. So if you own rental properties, like, you're going to get punched in the mouth. And it seems to be a combination punch. Usually it's like, furnace goes out at property X, that's going to cost $7,000 to replace. We have a roof leak at property Z, that's going to be a full replacement of the roof for $12,000. And then usually there's a third thing, and they just seem to come in threes. If they only come in ones, now I'm happy because it's like, oh, it's just this $5,000 expense. But I always set myself up because you're going to get hit multiple times in the mouth sometime, and it's definitely painful.
Yeah. So one other thing that was in your bio and when I introduced you was about the property management. How does that play into all this? Like, was that after you were, or was that your own property management from the rentals that you owned? Or did you work for a company? What's that like? What was that?
Yeah. So the company still exists today. It's called Prosper Real Estate, prosperpads.com. I have zero ownership in it anymore. But if you guys want to check it out, that's fine. What it was I started off and I kind of had like, I think mentors are really important. I had a mentor that was a few years older than me, had reached financial independence by like the age of 29. And I think he's 3 years older than me. And he had 30, 40 doors. And I would just ping him because I kind of knew him from college. We hung out in the same circles and I kind of knew who he was. He knew who I was. So it just made sense to ping him. And eventually a deal came across where it made sense to partner on it. So now we have, if you think about this from a logistical standpoint of LLCs and ownership, he has all his stuff. I have a little bit of my stuff and we have stuff we own together. So if somebody's coming to us, how do you market that? Do you say rent from Nate? His name is Chase. Rent from Chase, rent from both of us, or the names of the different LLCs. So we decided we need to put an umbrella over top from a marketing standpoint and saying, hey, this is our property management company. It doesn't matter what LLC owns the property, rent from Prosper Pads. So that's honestly how it came to be.
Okay.
And the reason we grew it from there is we wanted, one, to selfishly have more employees to manage our stuff. So one of the benefits of having a property management company is if you manage other people's assets, which we decided to do, is I can employ a CPA full-time. When Chase and I maybe had 60, 80 doors between us, it probably doesn't make sense to have a full-time CPA on staff. But if you're doing another 400 doors for everybody else, yeah, the payroll is there to support that. Or maybe we could have an HVAC maintenance guy on staff that helps us out on our own property, so we don't have to call HVAC company and pay market rates. So things like that, that were some of the driving factors. The other main benefit of managing units for other people is generally they kind of let you know one of the first calls if they're going to sell. And we've definitely been able to purchase a lot of assets from our owners because of that.
Yeah. So a couple of things that kind of came up for me there is a good reminder for our audience is something that comes up with probably everyone we speak with is the idea of having a mentor or someone to help educate you. And something, and I think in today's like Insta personality world, you have a lot of gurus, which I would not consider mentors. And so, like you said, you knew him from college. He was a few years ahead of you. So I think it's really important for people listening to realize that you can find people that aren't necessarily a guru online that are in your area, which kind of leads back to your other point of like, say I wanted to invest in Florida. I'm in California. I have a competitive disadvantage because I'm not from Florida. And what I would do personally is I'd probably reach out and partner with someone who was local to the area to learn all about that area, something, or, you know, invest in your area. I would be like, hey, no, I'm interested. Can I pick your brain? Another thing you mentioned was you did that partnership with him. So kind of learning and having skin in the game, I think it's important for people to understand. Now, okay, you talked about your partnership, your start, but you're like 200 doors. How did you scale? And then I think that kind of lends to your creative financing expertise. So talk to us about like how you scaled the business and things that you would recommend people look out for as like bottlenecks that you came across when scaling. And you kind of spoke to that a little bit with the hiring employees and whatnot, but yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So as far as like personally scaling, that mentor, that particular mentor was very good at seller financing. And what that is generally what would happen in a seller financing scenario, the most common one that I did anyways, is a bank would give me a first mortgage for 75-80%. Then a seller would lend me some of the down payment, generally between 10-20% of the down payment on what's called a second mortgage and a second position, as you're very familiar with. And that has its own set of terms and rules that you have to play by. You definitely have to let the bank know that it's happening and all parties are very disclosed. This was much easier, I will absolutely tell your audience, to do when I was really doing it hard, like 2014, 2017. It was easier. Cash flow was easier to come by. It's much tougher to do now, I'll be honest with you. But that eliminated the main bottleneck of all investors, which actually now I think it's a different bottleneck. But back then, I could literally pull up the MLS and find five projects, and they all kind of met my metrics, and we would pick which one we wanted to do, which if your audience is listening and they're somewhat new, they're like, no way is that possible. But it absolutely was back then. The bottleneck was capital. And that was the biggest thing. Even though I was a doctor making a very good income as a pharmacist, I probably had 60 grand a year left over to invest. I can only at 20% down only purchase $300,000 in real estate a year. That doesn't get you very far. So you need to solve that problem. Whereas in today's market, I feel like the deals are very hard to come by and the capital seems very plentiful to me right now, which I think is slowly going to fade away over the next 12 to 18 months. But that seems to be the market we're in right now. Like if you have a good deal in today's market, you can find the money. Good deals were, in hindsight, good deals back then were everywhere. It was money that was the problem to find. Does that make sense?
Yeah, which leads me to like 10 more questions and thoughts on every kind of season, or I guess you could say life cycle that we go through in real estate and in the market has its own pros and cons and bottlenecks. We look back when in 2008, 9, 10, I'm like, wow, those people were able to buy a house. I live in Santa Barbara on this great overlooking the ocean for $500K. That house is worth like $5 million today. There's no way. So it's like knowing what's going on in the market, what the bottlenecks are, and really finding, getting creative and finding how to capitalize on what isn't, what is available. So right now it's cash. How do you capitalize on that? How do you differentiate yourself to find the deals, which are not plentiful? Yeah, I guess those are kind of just my thoughts off of what you said, but in agreement there. So you did a lot of essentially seller financing.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really how it allowed me to scale. So instead of having 60 grand a year, I knew I could work with sellers and really open up and have an infinite amount of cash. Now, seller financing doesn't work in all scenarios. Generally, there has to be some equity there. You have to have a conversation with the seller. But honestly, when I was starting off, it was a lot of hat in hand. Like, hey, I'm 27, 28 years old. I'm just getting started. I have a strong W-2 income, but I just don't have enough cash to purchase your $500,000 property. I have 50K saved up. That's 10%. I have this bank over here that's agreed to give me 80%. So I'm at 90% of your purchase price. One, we can either come down on your purchase price, or if you'd be willing to give me a 50 grand second mortgage at 5% amortized over 20 years with a 5-year term, let's say, I can meet your purchase price of 500K. Would that be agreeable? Here's why it's good for you. Tax advantages, et cetera, et cetera. Back then, 5% was pretty good on your money. Today, that's not very good on your money. And here's why it works for me. I don't have to find another 50 grand. I'm a stand-up kid. I'm from this area. I was still investing just locally at that time. Here's the job I hold. Some sellers would even come visit me at a Walgreens, making sure like I was who I said I was. And like, I have no idea if it's true, but I've seen these like surveys that say like a pharmacist, like a retail pharmacist is the most trusted healthcare professional. So I don't know, they would come look at me and be like, he is who he says he is. He's trustworthy. But yeah, that's how a lot of those conversations went, honestly. And they didn't all work out, but yeah.
Yeah, I love that you just kind of gave your pitch, because I think that's something for people who might be listening. They're like, that sounds great, but like, how do I approach someone? What do I say? So I love that you kind of just went through like, this is a situation. This is how it works for you. Because I mean, at the end of the day, that's what the seller wants to know. Like, what do I get out of this? And yeah, this is why you should trust me, because it's trust and what's in it for them that I feel are the two biggest components.
Yeah, that's definitely the two biggest components. They just care what's in it for them. But they also, especially in negotiations, I feel like the other side, like each side thinks the other side is hiding what's in it for them. Like, what are you trying to get out of me?
Yeah.
I would always just come out and lead. I'm like, here's what I get. I don't have enough money to purchase your property. Yep. That's what I get. So if you're just upfront honest. Yeah, exactly. I don't think enough people lead with that, to be honest.
Yeah. And not because they're trying to like withhold or be shady, but I just don't think it's natural for a lot of people to say, this is what I'm getting. Like,
yeah,
I'm putting that out there. And I think if more people did that, there would be more trust built between two parties, which again, is not counterintuitive to a lot of people. Okay. So in today's market, obviously different bottleneck, as you alluded to earlier, what are some things that you would recommend to people who are looking to get started now? Like, what are some things off the top of your head? If they have great income, obviously deals are less. What are some recommendations, tips, tricks that you would give to them, or places you would start? Maybe it's not even in single family. Maybe there's other avenues. What are your ideas?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, like I said, it seems like deals are very scarce right now. I do believe that that changes over the next 12 to 18 months. But right now, if you got a deal, I'm ready to invest. Like, it's hard to find a very good deal with where interest rates are right now. So if I was a new investor right now, I would figure out my buy box, which is very important. I would only invest in duplexes built after 1940 in this market, or I only invest in single families. I'm going to house hack. It doesn't matter what it is. Define that. Then the piece that I think a lot of people overlook, and a lot of gurus, like you say on Instagram, are pushing, is I talk to young investors a lot. They reach out to me and I try to give them my time. All they seem to know about are these 30-year fixed mortgages. I think if you understand that there is a plethora of ways to finance a property, you are going to be so much better equipped to thrive in the next 24 months. The analogy that was given to me recently is most people are like carpenters with one tool in their tool belt. They see a screw in a piece of wood and they have a hammer in their tool belt. And they're like, well, I have a hammer. I'm going to hit this screw. But as we know, that doesn't really work with a screw, right? You need a screw gun. That is going to be so key in the next year or two, I think, to get deals done, is you better have the right tool in your tool belt to make this deal work. And what I mean by that is like, things that are going to work, I feel like, in the next 12 to 24 months are things like subject to land contracts, things that are way outside this 30-year conventional mortgage that is really, really expensive right now. I think it's at around 6.5. You probably know better than I do.
Yeah.
But yeah, It's not great. And it kills so many deals right now. Now, eventually that market's going to have to come back and reach equilibrium where some deals are going to pencil with traditional financing. But right now, if you want to get deals done, you need to get very creative and look at that as an opportunity. That's not a barrier. Like generally there's like, I forget the name of the chart, but it's two X, Y axis, four different boxes. And it's high barrier to entry from a knowledge standpoint and high barrier to a cash standpoint. And where you want to be ideally is in the upper right quadrant. So it's high barrier, low and high. You want to be at the high barrier of knowledge and high barrier of cash. That is where the thinnest air will be, right? Where the most deals will be. If it's a low barrier to entry of knowledge, which is a 30-year conventional mortgage, because everybody knows about that, and a low barrier to entry for cash, which is a 5% down 30-year conventional mortgage, everybody's playing in that pool. So you're going to get crushed unless you're like the best at it. And I just don't want to swim in that pool with those people. If you get up to the upper right, where it's a high barrier to enter for cash, which maybe isn't what a lot of the audience can do, but I'm just, from my analysis, like I'll play this out. You're going to eliminate a lot of people and high barrier to entry for like the financing and creativeness. You're going to be swimming with a lot less fish, and that's where you want to be. So I would study up on subject to land contracts. Generally, land contracts work the best if you can find properties that are free and clear. So older people own the home. You should be able to do these searches. This guy's owned this property for 40 years. Probably doesn't have a mortgage on it, or it's very, very small. That opens up infinite possibilities in how you can finance that property. You can just have a conversation with him and figure out the financing terms as long as he doesn't need the money. And here's like something that my mentor told me probably 6 months ago that really kind of hit me inside the head. And I do this a lot, like seller financing, but I never realized why it works quite a bit. Is if you have, say somebody's on a $1 million property that they own free and clear. If you tell them, here, I'm going to give you $1 million tomorrow, what are you going to do with it? They honestly don't know. And it kind of is really tough for them to decide that. They would be like, well, I need to invest some of it, but I don't know. Like, I don't think a lot of people want to go in the stock market right now. So they don't really know what they want to do with it. So my seller financing pitch to them would be like, hey, I'm going to give you a couple $100,000, maybe $150,000. And then you're going to give me a note for $850,000 that you're going to be earning interest on. I'm going to make a monthly payment to you. Yeah. So these people that are in retirement, here's a couple $100,000 that should serve anything you want to do from like a blowing a bunch of cash standpoint. And now I'm going to pay you $2,500 a month, every month. Does that sound cool? Yeah. Generally that resonates with people.
Yeah, for sure. I love that. And for one thing you mentioned too, just to like give our audience some education on this, can you talk a little bit more about subject two, what that is, how that works? Just because, again, wide audience.
Yeah, absolutely. So subject to assumable debt, and that's kind of the stuff that I'm getting at here. There are certain loan products, and generally the Freddie and Fannie financing are a little bit more rigid on this, but like FHA loans, commercial loans through banks, there's these products out there called swap loans. Those have generally language written in them that allow them to be assumable, meaning buyer number one comes in and sets up the loan. Buyer number two can come in and assume that loan. So let's say that you have a property for $500,000. It has a $400,000 note on it that the buyer one paid $100,000 down, 20% down, $400,000 note. 12 months later, another buyer can come in and pay buyer one, let's say $550,000. He made a little money. He can pay $150,000 down and assume the note of the $400,000 note that the buyer one had. And the reason that's of such advantage in today's market is debt that was made even a year ago is so much cheaper, like so much cheaper than it is right now. You should be getting in at like 3-4% interest rate versus 6.5%. And that is, I can't stress how important that is. If you run the numbers on a $400,000 mortgage at 6.5% versus 3%, you're going to see you definitely want that 3% debt, even if you have to go and put a little bit more money down. So situations where you can do that. And that's a conversation with, if you're working with agents and brokers, like, hey, is this debt that the seller has, is it assumable? It's going to be a conversation. And I think over the next 12 to 18 months, even banks, like I'm having those conversations right now with commercial lenders, and they're like, no, we really don't want the new buyer to be able to assume this debt. I think that's going to loosen up a lot because commercial banks have a lot more leeway on what they can do and what they can't do. If you're put in this Fannie Freddie box, which I know you guys are very familiar with, it's a very rigid box. And it's not like we can just bend these rules. But if you're in a commercial bank, like a local commercial lender on like a duplex or an 8-unit apartment building, there's really nothing they can't do if they like you enough or if they're desperate enough to create new business. And I've seen commercial lenders do some very creative things if they want to make deals work. And I think that that's going to happen, right? They haven't had to do anything in the last 3 years. Everybody's originating loans out their ears, but things are really screeching to a halt. So if they want to increase their amount of loans on their book or just not lose the loan that they had from the seller, they're going to be more open to those conversations, in my opinion.
Can you give some examples of why the first buyer would want to let someone else assume that loan? I can think of a few given COVID, but go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. So like price point, that's the biggest one, right? So if a buyer bought a property a year ago today, let's say it was January 1st, 2022, interest rates were at their rock bottom, I think. Still, you could get a 30-year fix for the high twos, but let's just call it 3%. Now, fast forward 12 months later, it's 6.5, let's say. I don't really know where it's at. But say that buyer came in, I live in Denver. They came in, got a job with Google here, and now have decided to switch jobs or just are transferred by Google 12 months later. They bought an $800,000 house. They have a $600,000 mortgage on it and they need out. That's a problem. That's a big problem because that house has definitely, by the rational mind, decreased in value because it now has to support 6.5% debt. Now, there's definitely some irrational minds out there that are just overpaying for things, but that property has gone down in value. If they want to somehow achieve that value, if they can somehow allow a buyer to assume that 3% mortgage they put on it a year ago, then the buyer rationally can reach up to a higher price because their debt payment or their monthly cash flow, which is honestly the king of all things, is cash is king. That monthly cash payment outflow to that property is lower. So they should be able to reach up higher in price. So that's why sellers should be interested in letting buyers assume their mortgages. That makes sense?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I was going to say, given that would have been my example. So I think that, like you said, that's probably one of the reasons you're telling people to look at this avenue because of the current climate of the market. So to kind of wrap this up, and we've covered a few of these here and there, if I'm someone listening and I have cash, have a good job, I have cash to invest, don't know where to invest it, know I want to get into real estate, you've given us some different avenues, but outside of, I guess, what's an actionable thing they can do to get started today? Whether that's, I'll kind of let you give me your action tip.
Yeah, absolutely. So my word of the year is discipline and patience. Like I lay goals out and I have like a theme for the year.
Patience should be my word of the year.
So I do want to preface this, like that is my word of the year. For one of the first times in my investing career, which is about 12 years long, I believe that in the next 12 months, I will see better deals than currently. And the old adage is buy real estate now and wait. And the best time to buy real estate was 40 years ago. The second best time is now.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's necessarily true. So I don't want to misguide. So I'm going to preface that with I'm trying to be patient. And I think some time needs to go by. So I think cash is going to be very king in the next 12 months. I think there's going to be a lot of distressed sellers eventually when commercial notes, which most of them are on 3 to 5 year terms, mean they re-up every 3 to 5 years. When those go up to the market rates, I think there's going to be some problems. I think people have overpaid for assets. So I will be in preparation mode, but for the 90% of time, as far as you should just take action. And I absolutely 100% believe that and understand that I'm coming from a point where if I don't buy another piece of real estate, I will be just fine. If you don't have any investments or a piece of real estate, you need to get some. And that is paramount. It doesn't matter what time in the market it is. I was on a podcast the other day. I was trying to flesh this out and I need to like get like a term for it. But if I were a new investor that had a bunch of money, or not a bunch, but let's say you can stockpile 20, 30 grand in a year from cash flow and just saving, like being frugal, etc. This is what I would do. I would develop a 3-year plan. On year one, I would buy a house to move in. Let's say it's a $500,000 house. I would go that 30-year product, like route 5% down, need 25K. I would be smart about it, knowing that in a year I want to move out. Maybe I'm renovating while I'm in it. I would want to move out so it at least breaks even cash flow wise when I rent it. I would be saving up throughout that year. I would do the same thing in year two and the same thing in year three, whether that's just tops. And maybe the third one is a duplex. You're going to stretch and you're going to get a duplex and you're just going to live in one side and rent out the other side. So at the end of 3 years, you have three properties. Then I don't care what you do. Like, you never, ever have to use your W-2 income again in this scenario to feed this investment. 3 years of discipline. You have three properties. Let's fast forward. You're just managing those properties. Let's go to year seven. So one of them has paid down for 6 years, one for five, one for four. I bet that at that time you can pull equity and buy three more. So you're at six, year seven. Let's go to year 12. You paid six of them down, five more years. If you want to, you can pull equity and buy six more. Now you have 12, et cetera, et cetera. If you just did it to that point and you had 12, and let's say that you're 30 years old, year 12 will put you at 42. You would have a lot of options at this point. If you just paid them down to the time you're 50, I promise you, you're going to be sitting on over $1 million in equity. Cash flows. The greatest thing about real estate is we lock in the debt payment, which is our number one biggest expense, especially in these 30-year fixed products. That's why they're so great. And our rents keep going up. So rents on that original property are probably 150% of what they were when you started, but that debt payment is still the exact same. And that is so powerful. And people just don't understand that. So in my scenario, you have to be disciplined for 3 years and then you can do whatever you want. Live life. You can hire a property manager at some point. By the time in that scenario, we started at 30, we're done buying at 42. By the time you're 50, here's your options. You can refi everything and reset everything to 30-year notes as long as it's not 8, 10% interest at the time. Be smart. But your monthly payments will come down thousands of dollars, which means your cash flow increases thousands of dollars per month. You could say, damn it, this Nate guy that I listened to on a podcast 20 years ago that said, just buy these three houses and just be smart with them over 20 years. I don't like that guy. I hate owning these properties for the last 20 years, but I have 12 of them. I'm just going to sell them and wipe my hands of them. I promise you, you'll have over $1 million when you walk away from all those sales. So you won't hate me after that. Or maybe you want to accelerate the pay down when you're 50 and be like, I want to have them all paid off by the time I'm 55, 58. I bet you can do that too. And then you have 12 free and clear properties by your late 50s. And it was all just because of 3 years of discipline. And again, will there be headaches along the way? Are you going to get a call about that leaky roof, that furnace that goes out and something else? A tenant needs to move out and you got a vacancy? Sure, those are going to happen along the way. But that's life. Like, life goes by no matter what we do. You better do something today that yourself 5 years from now is going to thank you for. And enough people don't do that, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I don't know. I need to work on getting more succinct with that example. Like, I just ramble on for 3 minutes, but hopefully that kind of lays it out.
No, that was good. I think that one might have been one of our best answers to the questions thus far. So bravo. I love that you laid it out of like, if I was a new investor, this is exactly what I would do. Because I think it's hard to look at someone who has 50, 60, 100 plus properties and be like, well, easy for him to say. But to put yourself in an investor, a new person's shoes and say, this is what I would do. And I think it lends to that power of, you see the snowball effect. Like, I think personally, there's a lot of like misconception about, you buy one rental property, you're good. Like, you got this. And it's not, it doesn't really work like that. You know, it's a, like you said, patience and consistency and showing up and doing it again and again until you're, like you said, at 12 properties and can capitalize on that. And it doesn't happen overnight. So no, I love that answer. I love that you went through it. You explained it. So I hope our listeners take something from that. But thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Just discipline and patience, I think, is the key. If you're a new person listening to this, even if you don't like real estate, if you just make the decision for the next 3 years, you want to max out your 401k and an IRA. I promise you, as long as it, like, say you're in your late 20s, that is going to pay so much dividends because time is so much on your side. And time, no matter where you're at age-wise, is never more on your side than today. That's just a universal truth. So whatever you're going to do, you better do it today and you better stick with it. Don't try it for 6 months and give it up. This is a 3 to 5 year plan. No matter what you do, it doesn't have to be rental properties. Just make a plan. And that's just not enough people do that, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And thanks for educating people, because big podcasts like this are how people get educated to do things, to take control of their financial future.
Yeah, I love it. I've really enjoyed this episode and our conversation. If people want to reach out to you or connect with you, how can they do that? Is there a way to do that? Are you open to that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've recently started like taking podcast interviews and putting out content on social media. Before, I was just in my businesses working, but my handle on Instagram is probably the best spot to reach out to me. I'm Dr._Nate_real estate. I put out daily content about the deals I've done. I lay out all the numbers. I give my advice on things. And if you reach out to me on there, like on my DMs, I don't have a huge following yet. So I probably will respond to you actually. So yeah, that's probably the best spot to reach out to me.
Get in before he blows up is what he's saying.
I don't know if I'm blowing up anytime soon or if I'm that knowledgeable, but I'm happy to help. Like, I really enjoy helping young investors out.
Love it. I love that. Well, thank you guys again so much for joining us today on this episode of the CWS podcast. If you're out there listening and you enjoyed the show, have feedback, send it our way, share the podcast with a friend, or subscribe and leave us a review. Thank you, everybody. Bye.
Thank you for joining Lauren and I on this episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. Each week, we bring you expert education, experience, and information in a digestible format to help you identify investment opportunities so you can build wealth through real estate and take action toward your financial goals. Enjoy the show, share with a friend, or subscribe to the show and leave us a review.